All right, ready to jump into another deep dive. Today, we're going to tackle a case that really makes you think about those everyday rules we often take for granted. Workplace policies, you know. Specifically, we're looking at Maldonado v. City of Altus. This one shines a light on language policies and whether requiring employees to speak only English at work. Well, could that actually be illegal discrimination?
You know, what's so interesting about Maldonado is it forces us to confront this idea that something as seemingly simple as a language policy, it can become a huge battleground for issues of cultural identity, even civil rights.
It really challenges our assumptions, right? You'd think in a country like ours, where English is so widely spoken, an English-only policy wouldn't be that big of a deal. But this case, it shows how those rules can have a real impact on people's sense of belonging. And it could even, you know, cross the line into discrimination. So let's rewind a bit. Altus, Oklahoma, back in 2002. What led to this controversial policy?
Okay, so picture this. Altus, Oklahoma, a city where, like many places, Spanish is spoken alongside English. Now, some city employees were using Spanish on their work radios, and this led to complaints from other employees who couldn't understand the conversations. So, in response, the city implemented an English-only policy for all city employees.
So, there was a genuine communication concern then. It wasn't totally out of the blue.
Yeah, you could say that. On the surface, it seemed like a practical solution, a response to a real issue. But the thing is, the devil's in the details. This policy ended up affecting, well, roughly 29 Hispanic employees, who were bilingual, speaking both English and Spanish.
Okay, so that's a significant portion of the workforce being impacted. Let's dig into the specifics of the policy itself. What did it actually say?
Well, it basically mandated that English be spoken during all work hours. Pretty straightforward. But there were two very important exceptions. The first one, employees could speak Spanish if they were communicating with members of the public who didn't speak English.
Makes sense, right? Essential city services and all. What was the other exception?
This is where things get a bit more interesting. The policy also allowed employees to speak Spanish during their breaks.
Wait, really? So it wasn't a total ban on Spanish then, but I have a feeling that's not the end of the story.
You got it. You see, while the written policy had these exceptions, the lawsuit alleged that in practice it was enforced much more broadly. Some employees even claimed they were reprimanded for speaking Spanish during their breaks.
So we have a discrepancy then between the policy on paper and how it was actually enforced. That definitely raises some red flags. What happened after the policy was put in place?
Well, according to the lawsuit, the policy created a pretty tense, even divisive atmosphere in the workplace. There were reports of increased ethnic taunting, some Hispanic employees being told to speak white, which, you know, really highlights the deeply personal and cultural implications of this policy.
Yeah, that's disturbing. It shows how something like a language policy, even if it was meant to address a practical issue, it could be, well, weaponized, right? And used to marginalize certain groups. Did the city ever offer any justifications for the policy beyond those initial concerns about radio communication?
They did. The city argued the policy was necessary for safety and efficiency. They claimed that having a common language, it was just crucial for clear communication, especially in situations where, you know, misunderstandings could have serious consequences, like operating heavy machinery or something.
Okay, so on the surface, that sounds like a reasonable argument. But was there any evidence to back it up? Like, were there documented safety issues before the policy was put in place?
That's where the city's defense kind of started to unravel. The court found that the evidence supporting their claims of business necessity, it was pretty thin, to say the least. They hadn't really documented any significant safety or communication problems beforehand.
So they were trying to solve a problem that they couldn't really prove existed. And that business necessity argument, that's crucial in these kinds of cases, isn't it?
Absolutely. To justify a policy that could be discriminatory, employers have to show that it's truly necessary for the safe and efficient operation of their business. And the court just wasn't convinced that the city of Altus had done that.
This is getting more complex than it seemed at first. But there's another piece to this puzzle. The mayor. I remember reading something about him making some pretty inflammatory comments. What was that all about?
Yes. During a news interview, the mayor, he allegedly referred to the Spanish language as garbage. He later said he actually said garble, but the controversy, you know, regardless of his intent, it became part of the legal proceedings.
Oh, wow. I can see why. Whether it was garbage or garble, the fact that it was even a question just adds fuel to the fire. It creates this perception that the policy might have been driven by, well, something more than just practical concerns.
Exactly. The mayor's comments, intentional or not, really contributed to this growing sense that this policy was actually targeting Hispanic employees.
So we have this English-only policy. It's creating tension. The city's justification doesn't seem all that solid. And then the mayor's comments just add another layer of complexity. This feels like a powder keg. What happened next? Did the employees just accept this policy?
No, not at all. They decided to fight back. They filed complaints with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and eventually they took the city of Altus to court.
Okay, so the legal battle begins. This is where it gets really interesting. Give us the rundown. What were their legal arguments?
Well, the employees alleged several violations. They mainly focused on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. One of their claims was disparate impact, meaning the policy disproportionately harmed Hispanic employees, even if that wasn't the city's intention.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
A policy like this would have a bigger impact on employees who primarily speak Spanish.
Right. And they also claimed disparate treatment, meaning they argued the city was intentionally applying the policy in a discriminatory way, and they used the mayor's comments as evidence.
So they weren't just saying the policy had a discriminatory effect. They were saying it was discriminatory from the very beginning. It's design and intent. That's huge. Were there any other legal angles they pursued?
Oh, they didn't stop there. The employees also argued the policy created a hostile work environment, and they cited those incidents of ethnic taunting we talked about. They even went as far as claiming violations of their equal protection and free speech rights, citing constitutional arguments and specific legal statutes like 42 U.S.C. Section 1981 and Section 1983.
Wow, they really threw the book at them. So what happened when this case finally landed in the court's lap? Was the court receptive to their arguments?
Well, the district court initially sided with the city, granted them summary judgment, and dismissed all the employees' claims. But the employees weren't giving up that easily. They appealed. And that's when things took a really interesting turn.
Ooh, here we go. So did the appeals court agree with the lower court?
Nope, not at all. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals actually reversed the lower court's decision on several key points. They said there was enough evidence to suggest that the English-only policy might actually violate Title VII. So several of the employees' claims were allowed to move forward.
So round one goes to the employees. What was the appeals court's reasoning? Why did they side with the employees?
The court really took issue with the city's lack of evidence. Remember, they couldn't point to any real safety or communication problems that existed before the policy. And the court also noted that the policy seemed to be enforced, well, more broadly than its written terms allowed, which raised concerns about potential discrimination.
So it sounds like the court was saying, you can't just impose a policy like this without a really good reason. And even if you have a reason, you can't enforce it in a way that unfairly targets specific groups.
That's a great way to put it. The court's decision emphasizes how important it is to be careful and consistent when applying these kinds of policies.
This is already so fascinating, and we've only just scratched the surface. I'm really curious to hear how the court addressed each of those specific legal claims, especially the Title VII violations. And we also need to talk about those free speech claims and what this case means for employers more broadly.
We'll dive into all of that and more when we come back.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Maldonado v. City of Altus. Before we left off, the appeals court had overturned the lower court's ruling and let some of the employees' claims move forward. Clearly, this case is about way more than just a simple language policy.
Absolutely. The appeals court's decision, it really opened up this Pandora's box of legal and social issues.
Let's unpack those Title VII violations. The employees claimed disparate impact, disparate treatment, and a hostile work environment. Can you break those claims down for us and explain how the court dealt with each one?
Sure thing. The court, they looked at the disparate impact claim first. Remember, that means the policy had a disproportionate impact on Hispanic employees, even if there was no intent to discriminate. And the court felt there was enough evidence to suggest that, yeah, this was the case. They cited EEOC guidelines, which emphasize that English-only policies, they can create this feeling of inferiority, of isolation, for people who aren't native English speakers.
So even if the policy wasn't designed to be discriminatory, the fact that it had that effect, that was enough to raise some serious concerns, legally speaking.
Exactly. And then we have disparate treatment. This is where it gets a bit trickier. The court found evidence suggesting the policy might have been intentionally applied in a discriminatory way. They pointed to things like its disproportionate impact, the lack of real business necessity, and the fact that management knew it could lead to the taunting of Hispanic workers.
So basically, the court was saying, hey, we're not buying that this policy was applied fairly across the board.
That's a great way to put it. And of course, there's the hostile work environment claim, which the court also allowed to proceed. They felt the policy, combined with those reported incidents of, you know, teasing and taunting, might have created a hostile environment for the Hispanic employees.
Those speak white comments were particularly awful. It's hard to imagine a more blatant example of how language can be used to create that hostile, intimidating work environment.
For sure. Those comments, they absolutely contributed to a sense of hostility, and the court recognized that. But even without the taunting, the policy itself could have contributed to that feeling of hostility.
This case really shows how language can be so much more than just words. It can be a weapon, a shield, you know, a way to include or exclude, empower or demean. What about those claims under 42 U.S.C. Section 1981 and Section 1983? Those are getting into more technical territory. Can you explain those for those of us who aren't lawyers?
Of course. So these sections of the U.S. Code, they deal with intentional discrimination based on race or ethnicity, violations of equal protection, and civil rights. Basically, the employees argued that the city's actions violated their fundamental rights.
And what did the court say about those claims? Did they just dismiss them outright?
Actually, no, they didn't. The court decided to let those claims proceed as well. They said the same evidence that suggested potential discrimination under Title VII, well, it was enough to warrant further examination of those claims, too.
So they weren't convinced that the city was totally in the clear, and they wanted to dig a bit deeper. This case is full of twists and turns, but we're not quite done yet. We still haven't talked about those free speech claims.
Right, you're right. Remember, the employees argued that the English-only policy violated their First Amendment rights. Their argument was that restricting someone's language, well, that restricts their ability to express themselves freely.
Yeah, I can see the logic there. Language is such a fundamental part of who we are, how we communicate. It almost feels like if you restrict someone's language, you're restricting their thoughts.
You've hit on a crucial point there. This idea of language as a form of expression, that's really central to this case. But here's the thing. The court ultimately disagreed with the employees. They upheld the dismissal of their free speech claims.
Wait, really? Why would the court side with the city on that?
Well, the majority opinion said that just being able to speak a specific language at work, it doesn't automatically mean it's a matter of public concern. And that public concern element, it's usually required for First Amendment protection.
So speaking Spanish at work, they didn't see it as addressing a larger social or political issue. It was more of an internal thing, I understand that, but it still feels, I don't know, a little restrictive, like we're missing something important.
You're not the only one who feels that way. And this is where the case takes another turn. One of the judges, Judge Seymour, he wrote a concurring opinion, meaning he agreed with the outcome of the case, but he disagreed with the majority on that free speech issue.
Hold on. A dissenting opinion within the appeals court. That's interesting. I'm curious to hear Judge Seymour's perspective. What made him feel differently about the free speech argument?
Well, Judge Seymour argued that the employee's use of Spanish at work in this specific context, it did count as speech on a matter of public concern. He pointed to the racial tension, the broader debate surrounding the policy. He suggested that the employee's choice of language, it wasn't just casual conversation.
So it became about more than just the words themselves. It was about the whole social and political climate and how language can be used to express cultural identity, even resistance.
Exactly. Judge Seymour, he saw the employees using Spanish as a statement about their heritage, their right to express that heritage, even in the face of what they saw as a discriminatory policy. He even criticized the majority for using the wrong legal test to assess the free speech claims.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. What was the right test, according to Judge Seymour?
Well, the majority had used this four-part test that's usually applied to retaliation claims, but Judge Seymour said they should have used a two-part test specifically for prior restraints on speech.
Prior restraint? That sounds serious. What does that mean?
It is serious. It means the government is trying to stop someone from speaking before they actually say anything. Think of it like the government censoring a newspaper article before it's even published. Judge Seymour argued that this two-part test, it focuses on whether the speech is a matter of public concern, and he said that was a more appropriate framework for analyzing this English-only policy.
So he saw the policy as an attempt to, I don't know, silence the employee's expression ahead of time, which he felt needed a different kind of legal scrutiny. That's a powerful argument.
It is. And based on that two-part test, Judge Seymour believed that using Spanish did touch on matters of public concern, meaning their First Amendment claim should have been allowed to proceed.
Wow, that dissenting opinion really throws a wrench into things. Even though the majority ruled against the employees on the free speech issue, Judge Seymour's perspective really suggests that this legal debate is far from over.
You got it. Judge Seymour's concurrence, it's a big signal that future cases, they might view language choices in the workplace very differently, especially when those choices are tied to issues of cultural identity and discrimination.
This case is just getting more and more interesting. Let's zoom out for a minute and think about the bigger picture. What are the key takeaways from Maldonado v. City of Altus? What is it to teach us about this whole complicated relationship between language, identity, and the law?
I think this case is a wake-up call for employers. It highlights that even seemingly neutral policies, things like English-only rules, they can have consequences that you don't intend. They can impact how employees feel about belonging, and they can even create an environment where discrimination can take root, even if that wasn't the original goal.
So it's not enough for employers to just say, oh, we have a business necessity for this policy. They really need to think about the potential impact it could have on different cultural groups and be prepared to back up their claims with real evidence.
Exactly. Maldonado emphasizes the need for a really thoughtful, nuanced approach to language policies. It's not just about avoiding lawsuits. It's about creating workplaces where everyone feels valued and respected, no matter what language they speak.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been taking apart this fascinating case, Maldonado v. City of Altus, seeing how something like an English-only policy, seemingly straightforward, can spark these huge legal fights about language, identity, even discrimination in the workplace.
Yeah, it's a big reminder that even in policies that seem neutral, the language we use, it can have all these ripple effects.
As we get into this last part of our deep dive, I'm curious to move from, you know, the courtroom to the actual workplace. What are the takeaways from Maldonado? For employers out there, how can they learn from all this and create workplaces that are both efficient and inclusive?
That's a great question. Maldonado actually gives us a roadmap for employers who want to get this right. The first thing is, it shows how important careful scrutiny is. Any workplace policy, especially one that could affect employees differently based on, say, where they're from or other protected characteristics, it needs to be looked at really carefully.
So it's not just a matter of having your legal team glance at it, right?
Yeah.
It's about taking a step back and thinking about the impact it could have on your workforce.
Exactly. And this careful look, it should go beyond just checking legal boxes. It's about understanding how a policy might make people feel. Will it make them feel like they belong, or will it create obstacles?
It's about a workplace where everyone feels like they can be themselves, in their own language, their own culture. That makes a lot of sense. What else can employers take away from Maldonado?
Communication. It's key. Before putting any language policy into place, you gotta have those open, honest conversations with your employees. Explain why the policy exists, how it'll work, and listen to what they have to say about it, their concerns.
Treating employees like they're part of the process. Not just people have to follow the rules. That kind of transparency, that collaboration, it can really build trust and prevent resentment later on.
Definitely. And that brings us to another crucial point, training. Maldonado shows us just how important it is to have training. For all your employees, especially managers and supervisors, the people who are actually putting the policies into practice.
Yeah, I can see how that's vital. You could have the best policy in the world, but if it's not applied consistently, fairly, things can still go wrong.
Exactly. Training shouldn't just be about what the policy says, you know, the specifics. It should cover the bigger picture, too. The legal stuff, the ethical considerations around having different languages in the workplace. Give everyone the tools to handle these complex issues with sensitivity, with awareness.
So creating a workplace that's truly inclusive, it takes more than just policies. It's about fostering an environment where everyone understands and respects each other.
I totally agree. Maldonado v. City of Altus is this powerful reminder. Language is tied to who we are, how we see ourselves, where we belong. And as workplaces become more diverse, it's even more crucial for employers to recognize that, to respect it.
We've covered a lot of ground, haven't we? From what went down in court to the wider impact on society. As we wrap up our deep dive, any final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the biggest takeaway is this. Language can be a force for good, or it can be used in harmful ways. to build bridges or to build walls. And as employers, as people in general, we have a responsibility to use it wisely, to create spaces where everyone feels valued, respected, heard, no matter what language they speak.
What a wonderful thought. And a perfect way to end this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us as we explore the twists and turns of Maldonado v. City of Altus. It's been eye-opening to look at how language, the law, and workplace culture all intersect.
My pleasure.
And to our listeners, keep those minds curious, keep those conversations going. Until next time, this has been The Deep Dive.